My name is Ian Boswell. I was a world tour professional cyclist for 7 years.
Skyrider from the USA is a fighter.
Well, Ian Boswell is turning up the cranks.
Also, the host of this fine podcast, Breakfast with Boz, being served by Wahoo. Breakfast with Boz podcast dives into the world of endurance sports, whether it's cycling, multi-sport, running, anything that inspires us to get out and move, we cover right here on Breakfast with Boz. Let's get cooking on Breakfast with Boz. Good morning, everyone, and welcome back to Breakfast with Boz, being served by Wahoo. I'm your host, Ian Boswell, coming to you with what could be called a pre-race breakfast this morning, something that I actually had very often before time trials back in my road racing days. My wife and I made a salmon Thai green curry last night. We had some leftover rice in the rice cooker, so I fried that up with 2 eggs, a little bit of Parmesan cheese on top. Something I really haven't eaten since I was probably racing back in the World Tour, but it is a very easily digestible breakfast. It is tasty. The Parmesan cheese helps, but you're about to find out why I've been deciding to eat an easier digestible meal this morning. So sit back, relax, and enjoy this week's episode of Breakfast with Boz, being served by Wahoo. In today's episode, I am joined by professional runner Ben True. I'm actually joined by Ben right now. We're getting ready to head out for a little run. Ben also holds the American record for the road 5K. So Ben's invited me down to his house. We're going to go for a run, then we're going to record an episode. So Ben, you said this is an easy run. What is that? What are we looking at? You said 5 miles. What's the pace?
Pace today, we'll see. I'll try to take it easy on you. We typically say 6:51 is the break-even point for these afternoon jogs. So if you go faster than 6:51, then you're kind of pushing the pace. But anything between 6:52 and 6:55 is fair game.
Okay, that's a pretty small margin. But I thought you said anything over 6:52 is fine. But okay, well, we're going to go run, and then we'll be back and, chat from there.
Yeah, sounds good.
All righty, Ben and I are back from our run. We did... It was actually, I just saw on Strava, it was my longest ever, longest recorded run.
Wow.
So we ran just over 5 miles, and faster, we beat your pace.
Yeah.
We ran too fast.
That's sure.
I think we did like 6:30 something average, but a little bit about Ben True. Tell us. I mean, I want to get to what is coming up next, but your background of running, I mean, you don't have to take us through everything, but you grew up in Maine and you have been running for, seems like, the majority of your life.
Yeah. I grew up in Maine. How did I really get into running? I really got into running because my dad was training with a neighbor for, I want to say, the 100th running of the Boston Marathon. So I was probably like 10 years old or 9, because it was, you have to qualify for the Boston Marathon. And so he was running all the time. So that was a cool thing to do. So there was a rec program in our town, and started joining the rec program, and I'd go for, a 3 to 5 mile jog with my dad and the neighbor, Steve, and kind of took off from there.
When you ran through high school, you ran through college, did you break the 4 minute mile in high school?
No, in college.
In college.
Yeah.
Well, it fascinates me just like doing more running, realizing how fast people are and the difference. And even before we had gone out for the run, you were saying that you could tell the difference between what we were running. I was like, can you tell our pace? And you're probably pretty accurate based off what pace you felt and what pace we were actually running, which is impressive. You've made a career off of anything from 5 to 10K, but now you're transitioning and you have a new frontier, and you're going for the marathon, which is actually coming up here soon, the New York Marathon, your first ever marathon. How's that feel?
Yeah, it's exciting. Never done it. So, it's a big unknown, and training for it is very different. So it's hard to tell what kind of shape I'm in for that sort of distance. It should be exciting. It should be fun.
So what's been the biggest difference between going from, I guess we should go back a bit. I mean, you went to the Olympic qualifiers in 2020, and then I guess it was, 2021, just before Tokyo this year for the 10K. And you were just off the mark of qualifying, which was, obviously a big goal to make the Olympic Games. is it not feasible to try and go for Paris in 2024? Is it, I mean, I guess as you get older, I mean, it's the same in cycling. The young kids are just getting faster. Is that something that this transition was brought on by, like, all right, you know what? As you get older, your endurance improves. Let's go to the next distance.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the standard progression. Everybody wants to be a miler, basically, but not everybody has the speed for a miler. And you learn pretty early on what sort of closing speed you have for a world-class event. And for a while, that was the 5K for me. And then as I got older, it switched to the 10K. But yeah, it's just tough to have, you know, that last 25-second 200 speed at the end of a 10K that the younger guys just have that little bit of a better kick for. And the longer distance is that, you know, culmination of the years of building up of that aerobic base. And yeah, I don't think 2024 is out of the question, but is maybe more closer to the marathon that I'd be going for.
Well, I guess there's still plenty of time to, like, go to New York, see how you're doing. I'm sure you probably will, you know, regardless of how it goes, you'll give a couple other marathons a shot, but you have fairly lofty goals. I mean, you've always been at the front of these events you're running. And you, I guess with data now and training, and you can kind of see where you're at. You have any anticipation of a time? I mean, I don't have no idea as far as like the mile splits and all that, but.
Yeah, I mean, New York is one of the marathon majors that doesn't have pacers. So it's one where it's really competition based. Both that New York and Boston are the two big ones that don't have any pacers. But New York is one that you also really race the course as much as you race the competitors. And it's something where you can easily have people who stay within themselves that go from 10th up to second in the last, you know, 10K because they paced it right. And then you have other people who are way out front leading who then fade to like 20th in the last, you know, 5K. Yeah. And so it'll be interesting to see. The field is pretty deep this year. Bekele, who's the second fastest marathoner ever, is in the field. There's the world half marathon record holder is in the field. There's a few previous podium finishers at New York City Marathon in the field. So it'll be an interesting field, but I'm excited.
I mean, approaching a completely new discipline. And I guess I had that experience this year with going to gravels. Like, I didn't know, I'd never done a 200 mile race before or even a ride. So it's like, you have no expectations, you know, there's no worry about, like, you know, of course you want to do well, but you're like, yeah, cool. Like every time you pass, like, you know, you'll pass 13 miles, you're like, sweet, I'm still in the front group. I mean, do you have almost in a way less pressure than you would at the Olympic trials for the 10K just because it is, I mean, you have personal expectations, but it's not a situation where you know what you're capable of yet, really.
Yeah. I mean, it'll be an interesting one because something like anything shorter, say a 10K, if you're not in the field the entire race, there's no coming back, yeah, right? No one's coming from, you know, getting dropped by 100 meters and coming back on the field. But something in the marathon, it's riding that line of knowing the paces that you can sustain and then how much you can go under and for how long you can go under, right? So say you're running, you know, New York is a lot of times one around 209 pace. And so that's 455 miles. And so say that.
That is so fast.
Say surges are happening and you know that you can run, you know, two 445s. But if a 430 is dropped, you need to only be able to run 1 mile and 440 before you tip over that threshold and there's no coming back. So you have to know your body and read your body as well as the competition as you're running, knowing that nobody can just start running 430s and just stay away. I mean, the only one who can do that is Kipchoge, but he couldn't do that at New York, right? Yeah. And so knowing that there will be moves that are happening and how much of that move you can cover at the time as you're feeling in the race, yeah, and how much you have to then claw back later on.
Huh. It's fascinating to me because, like, I always see running as such this pure sport where it's just like, cool, you just go as hard as you can for as long as you can. You either win or you don't. But, you know, speaking to you now, I realize it's a lot more like cycling than I think, where there is this, you know, I guess cycling, you have the benefit of having a power meter and you have a screen, you know, always right in front of you.
Yeah.
Obviously with, you know, GPS watches now you can, you know, see your splits, but you don't have this, you know. In cycling, you kind of know the physiological limits. Like, okay, someone's doing on this climb, you know, 6 point whatever watts per kilo. Like, cool, like I can hold this, but I can't go that much more for over 5 minutes.
Yeah.
So are you constantly doing, and I guess you haven't ran a marathon yet, but will you be doing like mental calculations as you run?
Yeah. I mean, you have to. So reality, the race doesn't start until, you know, maybe 20 miles in. Right. And you may be up in the front pack feeling good at 20 miles, but so is everybody else. The real racing doesn't happen till later on. And it's how you handle all that surging and the pace change on those tired legs later in the race that will you be able to stay with those top guys? Or will you then have to start running your own race, not worry about the competition, and just plug away at running an even 450 pace as the other guys are running 430, 5 minutes and bouncing around? But it's all that surging that really burns your glycogen stores and can really put you over the edge if you're not careful. So you need to learn what those limits you have placed are so that no one cares who's the first person to get through 25 miles. First person to get through 40K, the only one that matters is who crosses the line first.
True. Yeah, it is. It is true. I mean, there's so many new, you know, aspects to this because I assume in a 10K, you're not fueling.
Right.
And so, I mean, there's this whole new element of learning how to not just run that distance, which I'm sure you're always capable of, but not at these speeds, and then figuring out nutrition and, you know, all these other factors that you didn't have to worry about in a 10K. I mean, you had to worry about, you know, nutrition prior, but not mid-race.
Previous to this, never take nutrition through any training. You know, a typical long runs has always been 2 hours and would never take even water for that duration. On a really hot track day, I may have a bottle of water on the track to sip water on, but never take, you know, sugar along the time. And now learning how to both drink while running, as well as how to absorb sugar and to take in sugar to replenish those glycogen stores as I'm running at pace is a whole different issue. The biggest thing that I was finding is because I would do a bunch of these mod longs, which moderate long runs, meaning moderate effort. So you start at maybe a minute slower than marathon pace and you kind of progress down to marathon pace. So you're never running true tempo or threshold, but you're running fairly hard. And every time I'd go and start drinking a bottle, my mind would switch to focus on the bottle. And all of a sudden, I'd be running like 30 seconds a mile too fast. My immediate reaction was, there's chaos going on. I just need to start sprinting. And you can't do that if you're then trying to take in calories as you're picking up the pace. Yeah. That doesn't work. And so you have to, you know, keep being like, all right, relax, calm, allow your body to absorb all the nutrients that you're trying to give it right now and make sure not to have those weird surges in the middle of the race.
Well, is that something that, you know, the difference between, you know, training and race, especially if you're going to win, if you're going to finish the marathon, like, you know, you can be looking at, you know, your splits and, you know, keeping that on track. But in a race, is it almost going to be, do you think it'll be helpful because you're not going to necessarily accelerate if you're drinking because you're staying with that pack. When you're racing, you're not racing the time.
I think a lot of people accelerate, though. Yeah. That's the thing.
Everyone accelerates. Yeah, you don't realize.
I mean, New York City is notorious because there's one point where you turn on to First Ave. And the crowd there, you go over a bridge where it's really, really quiet. And then you turn on to First Ave and it's just mayhem of people watching spectators. And I've been fortunate enough that I've ridden on the lead vehicle of the race twice now. And so I've been able to see the entire race and see the energy through it all. And every time everybody picks up the pace, whether they think they're picking up the pace or not, everybody surges. And it's right around like 16 miles. And that is too early to actually like make your big move in a marathon. And the big thing is everybody would always tell me on the lead vehicle, all right, watch it. Everybody's going to pick it up right now when we come around because there's just so much energy. And how do you play that? I need to stay relaxed, but yet I need to make sure I'm staying in contact.
Yeah. You can't just let them go away.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh. And so you've scouted this race. You've had other really good results in New York before. Is there a reason that you chose this race and this course over something else? Is it a timing thing? Is it a course thing? Is it a, you know, association with good, you know, prior results in New York City?
Yeah, it's a little bit of everything. I mean, what I like about New York, first, the New York Roadrunners who are putting on the race, always fantastic job. They treat the athletes extremely well. Always had a lot of fun being at any of their events. And I just really like that New York, it's competition. It's not pace. Nobody's going after necessarily a time. Everybody's going after competition. I like that pure competition. The energy in New York is pretty unmatched. And I don't know, I've just had so many good memories of racing in Central Park for different races that I've done that, you know, how do you beat that? It's like one of the more iconic of the World Marathon Majors.
Is there anything things you're scared about going into it? I mean, just unknown factors?
Yeah, who knows how
shoes come untied? Yeah.
I mean, so because I've watched on the truck and I've been at the finish line and watched. There was a few couple years ago that my wife Sarah and I were at the finish line watching. And you know, the first few people come in and you're like, this is the greatest event ever. Like, look at these athletes running. It's so powerful, so inspiring. And then you stay and you keep watching. And then you get the elites who have not had the greatest day. And you see how much the marathon can beat you up. And you see these world-class athletes being absolutely humbled by the event. And you go, oh, like this is not that pure glory that those, you know, first maybe two or three finishers are doing. And then, you know, you have maybe the fourth through the sixth finisher that, you know, they look pained, but they, you know, are holding it together. But then you get some of the world-class athletes that just didn't have it for that particular day, and just everything hurts watching. And you're like, that's scary.
Yeah.
That's scary.
Yeah. I mean, 'cause there's still this, you know, there's the, you know, I think when most people sign up for a marathon, there's an intention of like, I'm just going to finish. But like, you're going there to, you know, to try and do the best possible result, try to win.
Yeah.
And that changes, like, you just push that much harder, almost to the point where it's like, you either, you know, get the result you want, or you, I mean, not, yeah, not you finish,
yeah. But
like, right. Cool. Like, I'm on the side of the road because I, you know, blew up. And,
yeah.
You know, is there a sense of, you know, accomplishment just in finishing it for you, or is that not enough?
No, I don't think that's enough. I mean, I think I'll learn regardless of my place. I'm going to definitely learn things both about myself and definitely about the event. But yeah, I mean, all through training, these long runs that you do that, you know, you're running basically marathon pace or a little bit faster at the end of, you're like, all right, I can understand this, but I've never gone 26 miles. And the first part was a whole lot easier than race pace. And you're at the back of your head, you're like, all right, when I actually hit mile 20 in the marathon, that was last 10K is when the race actually happens. How am I going to respond to that? What sort of place am I going to be in that situation?
Yeah. Well, and that's like the kind of the beauty of doing something new. And I'm sure it's probably in a way refreshing of like not knowing, because you know in a 10K, like, you know how it's going to play out, you kind of know all the athletes, you have your strategy and you have it pretty dialed, and then you're going to something new where it's like there's a lot of unknown. But it sounds like just through the experience of watching and seeing it and knowing these little things, like at mile 16 there's this crowd, like,
yeah,
those are very valuable lessons to know, like, people are going to pick it up here, like, be aware of it, because it's so easy to get sucked into an event. And before you know it, you're running way faster than you're capable of, just because the energy of right. the event. Well, what has been your longest run up to this point?
I've had a few at 22 and a half miles, but that's it.
So you've actually never ran 26.2 miles in your life?
I think I've done 25 mile long runs, but you're right. I don't think I've ever run 26 miles. Yeah.
No. So if this... You know, you said you're going to keep pursuing this. Is this something that you could set as a new long-term goal? Like, if this goes well, if you keep, you know, you realize, cool, I've found my new, you know, discipline of running, would you try to go for Tokyo in 2024?
Or Paris?
Tokyo already happened. Paris. Well, I got all confused.
I mean, so the interesting thing is, again, who knows how it plays out, but the training so far, I feel like I've been able to handle this training a lot better than I've been able to handle the track training. And so that both makes me excited, but also terrifies me. So it makes me excited because if this works out well, you know, the training for it has worked well for my body. I've been able to handle the high volume. I've been able to handle the workouts very well. The body has not felt broken down like it has for track training. But then you're like, well, does that mean that, you know, I didn't train hard enough for the marathon? The track, especially in the last few years, has really beaten me up. Just running that speed, that pace, and running on a track, which is so hard. There's never been, you know, in the last few years, a morning where I could wake up and walk down the stairs without immense pain.
And then you're still going out and running.
Yes. Yeah.
Goodness.
There's never been a time of probably more than like 3 weeks where I haven't had a nagging injury. But now, because of that pace, we've removed that pace. And then I'm still running like 10K race pace, but I'm not running that faster stuff. The body has just felt and responded so much better toward it.
So you've been largely injury free.
Yeah.
Knock on this wood table. Yeah. Up until, well, which is, I mean, it is interesting because you do knock down that intensity. And I mean, because running is a sport where like people are prone to injury, but
yeah.
I mean, the harder you run, the faster you run, can be incredibly, you know, damaging. So you think that the increase of volume reduction of just pure, you know, you're probably not doing 200 meter sprints anymore.
I am, but I'm not, it's not to the same extent that it would be before.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and one thing, we actually did record a podcast and it was never released in Boulder in 2020. I think we met in the spring. You were in Boulder and I was out there.
Right before the pandemic.
I had just gotten this equipment and I was just trying to get people to practice. But we spoke a lot about equipment and how, you know, coming from cycling, there's a lot of, you know, equipment makes a huge difference, you know, with aerodynamics and rolling resistance. And, you know, at the time we were talking about the evolution of shoes.
Yeah.
Where does that stand now? Because at the time you were, I mean, like I said, running's always been a very pure sport to me. Like, it doesn't matter what shoes I'm wearing, but more and more the equipment is making a difference. Do you feel like, you know, as that technology continues to improve, that we're going to continue to see faster and faster run times?
Yeah, especially if it's not regulated.
Yeah.
I think we've already hit technology that could bridge the gap between responders and non-responders and the talent gap. And I'd say that as if you are a responder to these special shoes, I think that wearing the shoes alone will bridge the gap of what used to be talent. And I've seen a few studies on the road. We've known that's happened very early on with Nike was the first one to market with these. And now all these other companies are coming up. But the times being run are undeniably faster. On the track, there's been quite a bit of studies that showed that while the pointy end of the field isn't really getting that much quicker, it's the middle of the road is catching the pointy end. And so they're closing that gap.
Yeah.
And so shows in like pure mathematic data sets that it's helping to bridge that gap of talent.
So essentially, if I got a pair of, you know, special shoes, it might help me out more than it's going to help you out because I have, you know, clearly worse form and, you know, less running ability. So it's the people at the front, you know, it's making a difference, but less so than people who have less technique and good form. Huh. So what do you think you're more tied into, you know, the running world and regulations. Do you think there'll come a point when they say, okay, this is the line, like this shoe is fast enough?
They have in the past set major lines, most notably in high jump. There was a time when they started getting bigger stacked shoes. And at the time, IAAF said, no, we can't do that. A high jump spike can only be 13 millimeters of insole. Like that was it. That's it. Because the higher stack up, the higher your center of gravity is, the higher you can jump. And they were very quick with that. They're not so quick with these new shoes. And they gave a lot of wiggle room as far as what the ruling are. So a traditional spike compared to that 13 millimeters of stack height for a high jump shoe is very similar. But all of a sudden, they went from a normal racing flat that might be 20 millimeters. And all of a sudden, now they say, 40 millimeters is fine. And that was because Nike came to market with a 40 millimeter shoe. And they said, well, we don't want to outlaw this one. We'll just retroactive. So they're starting to, but it sounds like basically right now, anything goes as long as you can fit it in within 40 millimeters and you don't have two overlapping carbon plates.
Hmm. Well, and I think we spoke about this last time because in cycling, you know, when I was racing, like they x-ray your bike and they weigh your bike and they, you know, do all these protocols and checks. Is there a...
They're going to have to start being.
Like, are they going to like start sawing apart shoes at the finish or I guess x-ray?
Yes, now
or...
they're starting to test shoes.
Yeah.
But as the ruling gets, now that there's different rulings for different events, even on the track. And so there's going to have to be that strong you know, check for spikes, because what you can run an 800 in versus what you can run a 5K in versus what you can run, you know, cross country, it's all going to start changing. And so it's going to be interesting. And already companies are coming out with shoes that are beyond spec. The first one to market was Adidas came out with, like, it's called like the Primex, which is 50 millimeters. And they're like, well, if you want to win the race, you can't wear this. But for all you other people, wear this and you're going to run even faster and close that gap to those elites even more.
So only the professional athletes are regulated by the shoe.
The average Joe can jump into the New York City Marathon and with these super illegal shoes and be perfectly fine and set a new PR.
Huh. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to me to comprehend that, because in cycling, you're so accustomed to these rules and, you know, regulations and everything. And I never realized that there's so much, you know, happening within the running space that actually is affecting you know, speeds and times. And, you know, obviously the 2-hour marathon was broken, and it's like, you know, so what is the limit of human potential, but also technological, you know, advancements?
No, it's interesting. I mean, like swimming, for example, right? You're just a human swimming through water, and they had all these advancements with the swimsuits, and then they banned the swimsuits. And now all this technology is going into how to design the pools. And now all these records are being broken because pools are just becoming so much faster. You're seeing that. You've always seen that in track, right? You had the cinder track, and then you started having different, you know, urethane tracks, and you have Mondo tracks. And now there's, you know, certain densities that you can have a track and firmnesses that you can have a track, but you can build those on top of substructures that also add a little bit of bounce that help. And so you have this whole game both in the track development as well as in the, you know, spike development. We haven't seen that in road running before, because a road is a road and you can't really redesign the road for running, right? No one's going to do that. But now the new shoes have really shown there can be a lot of changes. And again, there's responders and non-responders. And so basically, if you can't respond to that, you're toast. There's been a lot of injuries based on them because it forces gaits to change, but you still have to run them in them because they're the faster shoe. And so it's going to be interesting to see in, say, 10 years what happens. Is everybody faster, or is a whole lot more people injured? How that works. For me, for example, I refuse to work out in the carbon shoes and, you know, just wear them maybe one workout before a race to just get used to them. But there is that difference as well.
Huh. Well, because in cycling, you know, for a long time, there was the hour record and, you know, it was like had to be ridden on a certain bike. And then all of a sudden, you know, technology, people were, you know, on these crazy, you know, Batman bikes.
Right.
And then, you know, then they reintroduced it, but like there's, you know, the Eddie Merckx hour record. And now there's like the, you know, modern UCI hour record. Do you think that there'll come a point in running that there is, it's almost like a dated, like, you know, pre whatever shoe and post, and then it's like they're just separate records and you can't compare, and you might get someone who's like, hey, you know, I'm going to go try to break this, you know, marathon record that is with old shoes or like a basic shoe.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, then what do you know, then you have too many record books. There's already people that are like asterisking any of their recent records, but then you can go back to, you know, is Carl Lewis actually have a faster 100 meter time than Usain Bolt because he ran on his on cinder tracks, and cinder tracks are that much slower, right?
Yeah. At some point you have to stop comparing.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're here now. Yeah. Yeah. Well, another thing we spoke about at the end of the run was aerodynamics. And I guess the speeds in which you're running, it does make a difference. You said you like, you know, drafting and being in a group, whether it's, you know, it's the psychological benefit of just being there or actually the wind resistance does make a difference. What do you think that, I mean, you probably know pretty specifically, what is that difference at the pace you're going to run a marathon at?
I mean, I think running a marathon, it's, unless there's a headwind, you're slow enough that it's more psychological than anything else. Because you're only running 12 miles an hour, right? And you know, even you on a bike, 12 miles an hour, when you're climbing a hill, you're like, well, does it really matter that I'm sitting in somebody's draft or not? But a while ago, Nike did come out with these shark skinned tape that you would tape on the side of your arms and legs to help cut down wind resistance, even for the marathon.
An airfoil.
So perhaps they did wind tunnel testing and found out there was a marginal gain.
Will you be using those?
No, I will not be using that. But you know, it you know, at some point I've always thought is that that marginal gain for example, the side tape, are you then losing it because you're now not like sweating as well through that, you know, part of your leg and now you're slightly overheating or, you know, so
like I said, is the nice thing about New York City Marathon being in November is that it's not crazy hot.
It shouldn't be.
Yeah. It could be. Yeah. Well, going back to the marathon and New York specifically, is there in your eyes, what defines success? I mean, clearly finishing is, you said it's almost irrelevant compared to the performance. Is it a time? Is it a placing? Is it a feeling? Is it even like if you get to the finish, you're like, hey, I didn't perform as well as I wanted to, but I learned a lot. Or is there a specific, like, this is success. This is not a failure, but like, you know, I guess regardless, you're going to learn something.
Yeah. I mean, the competitor deep down inside me would be like, if I'm not on the podium, the top American, it's going to be a failure, right?
Yeah.
But I think regardless, I will learn a lot about it. And the biggest thing is, can I come away knowing that one, it is repeatable. I could do it again.
Yeah.
If I do well. And if I didn't do well, do I see that I could improve? Would be big ones. I mean, if I go out there and I just hate every minute of it and I just blow up and I'm like, that was the best I could possibly ever do. I could never see myself being able to handle those 26.2 miles any faster. Yeah. It would be a success in knowing that I'm not going to do it again. But I would see that as a failure on most fronts. Yeah.
Okay, time for ultra running.
Yeah.
Well, that's, it is all fascinating to me. And, you know, it's cool to like, you know you somewhat personally, but like also realize how humble you are and how kind of hidden you are here in, you know, the Northeast of the US. And, you know, with the ambition of like going to be the top American is very impressive. So I appreciate you taking me for your easy run.
Oh yeah.
Good luck in New York.
Oh, thank you.
We'll have to catch up maybe after New York City.
Sounds good.
And I guess how can people follow along on the journey? I know you have an Instagram.
I have an Instagram, which is, I don't even know if I know my Instagram
handle.
Ben True.
Yeah.
Strava. I've actually been posting my entire build up on Strava. You can follow the race. There's always a tracker for at New York Roadrunners for different athletes.
And is it televised as well?
It will be televised.
On NBC or something like that?
Honestly, I have no idea. Yeah. ESPN. I don't know.
ESPN.
It is always televised,
yeah. But
where it's televised, I'm not sure.
Okay. Awesome, Ben. Well, thanks so much for the time. And call me next time you have an easy run.
All right. Sounds good. Thanks.
Well, there we have it, folks. Another episode of Breakfast with Boz being served by Wahoo. I hope you enjoyed today's episode and my conversation with Ben True. I do want to let you know that on October 29th, there is a new Wahoo Frontiers film featuring Ben True. So head over to Wahoo's YouTube channel and subscribe. Be sure to check that out. And then on November 7th at 9:05 Eastern Time, Ben will be taking part in his first ever marathon. I will be following along, and I hope that between the podcast and the new Wahoo Frontiers film, that you become a fan of Ben and decide to also tune in and cheer him on November 7th. So until next time, folks, stay safe, stay healthy, and I'll catch you back here next time on Breakfast with Boz being served by Wahoo.